I'm Andy Borowitz, in today for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. Man, I hate interrupting that song. It makes me seem like the bad guy, doesn't it? In the summer of 1964, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas released that great anthem, Dancing in the Street. And according to author Mark Kurlansky, the song not only made a big impact on the Billboard charts, it also changed America forever. In his new book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America, he describes how the song arrived at a watershed moment in American culture and politics, and the interesting ways it's been reused since its original recording. It's published by Riverhead, and I'm so pleased to welcome Mark Kurlansky back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Andy.
So before we get into this book, I just have to ask you, you know, you've written such books as Salt and Cod, and you take on these what seem like very minute topics, and then you turn them into the universe somehow. How do you decide, for example, with Dancing in the Street, how did you decide that this one song, this one pop song, was going to hold up over the course of an entire book and hold your interest for the amount of time it would take you to write it?
Well, I mean, first of all, Andy, you have to understand that I don't try to do weird, quirky topics. To me, these things are huge.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And then it's just about wanting to tell people why they're huge.
I see. So how did you know, I'm just curious, how did you know that Cod was huge? Because that wouldn't have occurred to me.
It was just a great story.
It was just a great story.
It was a great story.
All right. Well, we'll have our readers get to Cod. I'm sure you've talked about Cod for many, many years now. So we'll get on to Martha and the Vandellas and Dancing in the Street.
Yeah.
What first grabbed you about this as a topic for a book?
The fact that it had so many historic and political implications, and yet it's not apparent. I mean, if you listen, as you just did, what do you hear? You hear a great
pop
dance
song
and
yeah.
It just makes you want to move.
Yeah.
You know, one of the all-time great R&B bands, Fred Waits, the drummer, pounding the second and fourth beat like a gunshot, and it's just a great song. And, you know, when I first heard it as a high school student, I heard it like that as a dance song, and I loved it. I was always glad at dances when Dancing in the Street came on, because you could really dance to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you don't have to be good to dance to Dancing
mm-hmm.
in the Street. And then a few years later, with the Vietnam War and Black Power and all these things happening, and, you know, and I was a college student at a time when college students were taking to the street, and it meant something entirely different. That's what the song Dancing in the Street meant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like it went along with us. It grew with us. And so it was an opportunity to talk about several things, why songs are important, and also the intersection between the struggle for black rights and music. I mean, the whole history of American music would have been completely different if there had not been a civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about how this song came to be in the first place? Who wrote it? How did Martha Reeves get involved? Who was she? I want to hear the origin story.
Yeah, this is a funny story, actually, that Martha wasn't actually aware of. The song was written by Marvin Gaye and Mickey Stevenson, who was the A&R director of Motown, the guy who picks the artists, and Ivy Joe Hunter. And the three of them wrote it together in Mickey Stevenson's attic for Mickey's wife, who was Kim Wesson.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it worked at Motown and at some other studios also is that you made a demo tape.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave the artist the demo tape, and she could listen to it for a while before she did her own tape. So Marvin Gaye was in the Motown studio singing the song, trying to make a demo tape. And Martha Reeves, who was in her early 20s but had already had three hits, came into the studio. Everybody used to hang out at the studio and, you know, eat some chili, look for a little work. Maybe you can pick up a song. And she heard that Marvin Gaye was in the studio singing. She loved Marvin Gaye. She used to sing backup for Marvin. And so she went in there. And Marvin Gaye looked at her and said, why don't we let Martha sing this? Now, for the past 50 years, Martha has remembered this as Marvin Gaye at that moment deciding to give the song to Martha. That's not what happened at all. What happened was he thought, you know, she would make a better demo tape. And she sang it once, and the story is that she always knew. They made some glitch with the recording. It didn't pick up the recording. They said, we didn't get it. You have to do it again. So I was sitting there in Martha's living room with Ivy Jo Hunter, who's the one who told her she had to do a second take. And I was just curious, the obvious question, so which take was better? And Ivy Jo said to me, look, you've got this young artist, and she's sung the song, but you think she can do it better. What are you going to do? Are you going to say, come on, do it again, you can do it better? Or are you going to say, the recording didn't work, we'll have to do it again? And Martha's sitting there with her mouth open. She had never realized that this was all a lie.
So they're just putting one over on her.
Right. And she sang it again, and they just, they didn't know what to do. I mean, Mickey Stevenson's there in the booth. He's promised the song to his wife. and they had to go with her. This recording was just, you know, it's...
And was she recording it just solo or with were the Vandellas in the studio?
No, the Vandellas weren't there. The track had already been recorded. She's listening to the track on earphones. They called in the Vandellas afterwards, gave them 40 minutes to learn their part. Roz Ashford said to me, you know, she just had a scrap of paper and it says, yeah, yeah, dancing in the street, doo-doo. And... you know, and then they put it together, and Barry Gordy said, yeah, this is what I want Motown to sound like.
Now, interesting, you mentioned that, you know, Barry Gordy was doing black music with black artists, but he was intending it to some extent for a white audience. Is that
not
true?
Not for some extent.
Was that just because it was a much bigger market and he decided he could make more money?
Eight times the market, and this was a new thing that started coming about in the 1950s of white people listening to black music, and it was a tremendous opportunity for black artists. This is something that happened because integration was the new big idea. And in fact, you know, all these people who were angry about the rock and roll, what they were angry about is that it was about integration. You know, white supremacists warned that this music is going to lead to integration. Martin Luther King credited the music with leading to integration.
I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. And I am speaking to Mark Kurlansky, who has written a great new book called Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. So let's talk about, we've talked a little bit about how the song came to pass. They go in then and record Martha with the Vandellas, do the definitive version that we all know and love today. What was the original release of the song like? What was the original response to it?
Well, it came out on July 31st, 1964. And, you know, it was not one of those songs that took the world by storm, which often happens with music.
Where did it get to on the Billboard charts?
It got to number two. It never made it to number one.
Number two is pretty good, though.
Number one was Manfred Mann, Doo-Wah Diddy Diddy, you know, which proves that, you know, the songs that endure are not necessarily the ones at number one.
Right. And Doo-Wah Diddy Diddy never became a civil rights anthem in the same way.
Not to the best of my knowledge.
That could be your next book, of course.
But it wasn't until October that it got to the top of the charts.
Mm-hmm. And where was it being played? I mean, was it being played on, you know, white stations, you know?
It was being played on white stations. I mean... Cousin Brucey told me he was so glad to get it. You know, it was a great song at a time when there weren't a lot of great songs that weren't British. And 1964 was also the summer of the Beatles
right? Hard Day's Night.
And so it was on, you know, white stations. And, you know, we're talking number two on the white chart. You know, Billboard used to have a separate white and black chart. Motown music was engineered to sound well on car radios and on small transistors.
Mm-hmm.
because that is the technology that completely changed music, mm-hmm. that it became portable and kids could go out and listen to music on their own. Before that, the way kids listened to music is they sat around the living room with their family listening to music. And that's why it wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that the music industry started aiming music at young people, because young people could now go off and listen to their own music. This was a watershed change in music.
Now, when Marvin Gaye wrote the song, was he intending it to have any kind of political meaning, any kind of was supposed to be relevant to the movement in any way?
This is the question. And, you know, I talked to Mickey Stevenson about this, and I talked to Ivy Joe about this. I couldn't talk to Marvin Gaye about it because he was killed, shot by his father. And Marvin Gaye was a very political person.
And he wrote other songs that were overtly political.
He had a constant, ongoing argument with Barry Gordy, saying we have to be more political. We have to have songs about what's going on. After the Watts riot, he really hammered this and you know, really didn't get his own way till 72 with what's going on. So was this song a way of getting out something political that was hidden, you know, which was a very old tradition in black culture,
sure.
Called masking. You know, possibly his contribution to the song was the title Dancing in the Street and the list of cities. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that list of cities, they're all cities that at the time had large, volatile black communities.
Chicago, New Orleans. Yeah.
Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Washington, New York, mm-hmm. and L.A., and don't forget the Motor City, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, came about because Marvin Gaye was listing all of these towns, and he didn't list Detroit. And Ivy Joe said, hey, don't forget the Motor City, and it went into the song just like that. You know, and this was a time in which these urban insurrections were exploding in all of these black ghettos, the first of which was just before this song came out in Harlem. And, you know, here's this song. It says, calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat? Summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the street. Mm-hmm. And then it lists all these volatile black cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's not what they intended, it certainly is what a lot of people heard, mm-hmm. especially in the Black Power movement. Mm-hmm. Mickey Stevenson said, you know, that's not what I was going for at all. I was trying to do a song about integration, mm-hmm. about black and white kids being on the street together, and it didn't matter what color you wear, mm-hmm. or it doesn't matter what you wear, it's just as long as you are there. You know, and the song has gone on to mean different. Sarah Dash, who sang it with Laura Nero and Patti LaBelle in 1972, said that she was absolutely convinced this was a song about the emergence of feminism.
Mm-hmm. So she repurposed the song.
It has these wonderfully ambiguous words, these stirring words that could mean almost anything.
Mm-hmm. There are so many cover versions of it. I don't know. Do we have the Kinks version?
Oh my God!
Do we have that available? We're checking on it. Well, the Kinks gave sort of one of the more laid back versions of it. We may not have that, but
it was actually one of the first covers, and I think one of the less successful ones.
Right. Well, the least successful one, which I guess we'll hear in a little bit, is 1985's "Unforgettable." David Bowie,
yes.
Mick Jagger collaboration, which is, it's really worth watching the video on YouTube, mainly just to read the comments about it.
Yeah. This is something that everybody loves or hates.
It's possible to do it simultaneously,
yes.
in the case of that.
This is the only cover of Dancing in the Street that made it in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. At a certain level, it's kind of awful. I mean, they do it in a way in which the song really doesn't mean anything.
I think if Mick Jagger and David Bowie had done it instead of Martha Reeves, there would have been no movement. I think
yes.
they would have destroyed the movement.
I think
would have started an entirely different movement of guys kind of, I don't know, flouncing about together. It was really strange.
Well, I had this brilliant idea. I called all these gay activists from the 80s and asked them, you know, was there any thinking about using this recording as a – and nobody ever thought
that
of it.
Wasn't
I think,
that,
I think
that.
They missed something there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is do you think that this is a song that's going to have resonance and for the next generation? Is this a song that's going to have other lives beyond what we've already seen?
I think it will live on and on, because it is musically so great, and it's inspirational. You know, there is this movie. People are probably surprised they ever bring up this movie, Sister Act 2. Whoopi Goldberg goes out in the street. She's trying to raise money for a school glee club, and she goes out in the street in San Francisco and sings Dancing in the Street, and people kick in money. That's it. You can do it. H-Rap Brown did the exact same thing with Black Power rallies. I mean, you can use it for whatever you want, but the song has its own power, and especially right. that recording.
Just don't use the Bowie Jagger version, whatever you're doing.
I would worry about the Neil Diamond version also.
I've been speaking with Mark Kurlansky, author of numerous books. Well, here it is. Most recently, Dancing in the Street, about the epic 1964 song. I can't do the straight face. His book is published by Riverhead. Mark, it's been a pleasure. And we're going out with David Bowie and Mick Jagger. I apologize, New York.
Now
thanks
you've
again,
done it.
Mark.
Nice talking to you, Andy.
Bye-bye.